quantization is so familiar that you don't choose to re-examine whether it's the right thing or not. I'd like to look at that question and show you where we can actually do better than we are currently doing. In the book by Landau and Lifshitz, there's the following sentence: "Thus, quantum mechanics occupies a very unusual place among physical theories. It contains classical mechanics as a limiting case, yet, at the same time, it requires this limiting case for its own formulation. No other theory has that kind of feature." That means that the classical world and the quantum world exist side by side. Over here, classical theory, for example, for a single degree of freedom would have two dimensions in phase space where h bar is zero. Over here, quantum theory, h bar is greater than zero. It's a job that we do to pick a classical theory and unite it with a quantum theory. But of course, this is a fictitious world. As we now know, h bar is not zero. This hockey stick depends on atomic properties to keep it together, where h bar is important, even though it's a classical object with which I could make a mark on your body if I chose to. So, what is the story here? There are several different possibilities that can happen when we take a classical theory to a quantum theory. Here, indicating that we have h bar, a new parameter, we could have lots of choices of the h bar dependence over here. That's a very complicated story. We would like to narrow that down, and we typically say observations of our system will do that. So we have a classical system here, a quantum system here. So if I go in this direction of the arrow, I am quantizing. If I go in this direction of the other arrow, I am dequantizing. Start from a given classical theory, go to a quantum theory, and go back to the original classical theory. This situation, I believe, is also possible. We could have a single classical theory and two or more of the quantum theories which are relevant for different physical situations. For example, if I take a harmonic oscillator, then there are certain problems in which the ground state energy is present, h bar over 2. But if that oscillator is one of the infinitely many degrees in a field, we have to subtract off that h bar. So that's technically a different point in this thing. And over here, we have a very strange, unwelcome story. We start with the classical theory, we quantize it, then we take the classical limit, and we go back to a different theory. A typical example of that, or at least a famous example of that, is the 5/4 scalar interaction in 4 and higher dimensions. 4 has not been rigorously proved, but Monte Carlo and renormalization group suggest that's true. 5 and higher dimensions have been rigorously proved. That you start with a given non-trivial classical theory, you go to a free quantum theory, which comes back to a free classical theory. That is an unnatural behavior. Indeed, we can look at this story with certain emotions. In the first case here, we're not done yet. We have to look up which one of these we have to choose. We're happy with either a single association or perhaps a double, but this one causes us pain. It is not a good one to deal with. I'm going to show you an example in our improved quantization, an example of exactly this kind of problem and how it gets resolved in the new version of quantization. Now, we typically take a pair of canonical variables, P and Q, promote them to operators, capital P, capital Q, let's call them, in the Hilbert space. So which pair of canonical classical variables should we choose? It's not given to us by the prescription. Dirac says, if the system does have a classical analog, its connection with the classical mechanics is especially close, and one can usually assume that the Hamiltonian is the same function of the canonical coordinates and momenta in the quantum theory as in the classical theory. In other words, take the classical Hamiltonian HPQ and substitute for C number P's, Q's, the operators. Of course, there's a footnote to this, and the footnote says, this assumption is found in practice to be successful only when applied to dynamical coordinates and momenta referring to Cartesian system of axes and not to more general curvilinear coordinates. That's a very fundamental point. It's true. But why is it a footnote? Why is it not upstairs in the main text shouting its importance? I believe it's because Dirac didn't know where this Cartesian system comes from. Because the Hamiltonian theory does not involve Cartesian coordinates, it involves a symplectic structure. So there is no Cartesian coordinates for your canonical coordinates to be referenced to. Nevertheless, we have this assertion that Cartesian coordinates are the best. I'm going to resolve those problems for you. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to make classical theory a subset of quantum theory. H bar is going to be positive all the time. H bar is never going to go to zero, unless you perversely want to go back to your former story. But this is our goal. Three basic topics. The first is the outline of the new version of classical quantum connection. Of course, traditional quantum procedures, traditional canonical quantization works for many systems. So I must be able to reproduce all its successes, but I want to do better for when it fails. So to give this business a name, we'll call it enhanced quantization. There's going to be canonical and affine structures, you'll see. And we'll talk about enhanced classical theories, which simply means it's a classical formalism in which H bar is not zero, H bar is positive, and it enters into the formulation, at least just as a coefficient. There's going to be two toy models to do it, and then a more serious model, which will show us this unwelcome story of a classical theory going to a quantum theory, but then on dequantization, it goes back to a different classical theory. Topic one, classical and quantum formalism. This is when they're separate. That's what we've been talking about. We're going to introduce canonical coherent states. That will make the classical theory a subset of the quantum formalism. We'll revisit canonical transformations in Cartesian coordinates and see how they can actually be included. We're going to introduce affine variables. Perhaps some of that's new to you, along with canonical variables, and show that affine quantization can be viewed as canonical quantization as well, and with positive features. Here's the standard story. We have two action principles. First, the classical action, PQ dot minus the classical Hamiltonian. Stationary variation list gives us Hamilton's equations. And the solution is given by this initial data belonging to a space of R2. That's our phase space. Quantum action is here. Variation of this with respect to psi bra or psi ket. A stationary variation can lead to Schrödinger's equation. And again, the solution is a vector in Hilbert space. This is its initial point and go on. So this is our very different structure. Now, let's take a more serious look at the quantum story. Here's our quantum action. And suppose we have restrictions on the variations we can make. We're not allowed to vary over arbitrary or general vectors in the Hilbert space, but some subset. As an example, let me talk about a half space. Let's imagine this platform here is the real line, and I have functions which run up and down along this line, but then I'm going to cut it in half, and say the functions are all zero on that side, and there's something else over here. So if I have a function over on this side alone and another function on this side, and I add them together, it's still a function on the right-hand side, my right-hand side. So that makes it a subspace, because if I can add two elements together and get another one. So that's the one we're going to talk about. This is like a projection operator acting on all those. You get a reduced form of Schrödinger's equation where the Hamiltonian is of this kind. This is a vector still in Hilbert space, and it evolves in that particular way. So that's the story of a subspace of the Hilbert space. But we're going to be more interested in subset, where these vectors don't form a linear subspace, but they are a subset. Now, let me give you an example of a subset. Suppose we're talking about purely Gaussian functions, a Gaussian function. And I'm going to sacrifice myself and say that I am a Gaussian function peaked at the top of my head here on this thing. I can be somewhere else on this thing. I can be smaller, etc., but I'm still a Gaussian. But I cannot sum two Gaussians together and have a Gaussian again. So that's a subset. Let's work with that in mind. Here we go. What is the restricted variation of interest to us? Let me remind you about how we deal with problems in our sun. I'm talking about the sun around which the Earth goes around, the sun which heats us every day. I want to discuss the dynamics of what happens in the middle of the sun. You and I will never visit the middle of the sun, so we have to postulate some behavior. First, I'm going to choose inertial coordinates because I know the dynamics is simplest in inertial coordinates. And then I will put in some functions and let them act. Okay, that's enough about the sun. Let's talk about our macroscopic variations, the ones we can do as a macroscopic person on a microscopic state. I'm going to recognize that the elements in this variation are functions in a L2 space. So I'm going to choose a function, just at the choice. Could be a Gaussian, could be something else, but I'm just picking it out of the air. And then I say to myself, I want to find variations that I can make on that function. For example, suppose this is my tiny system. This little card is my system. I could imagine moving that card to a new position. But I am promising you I shall not disturb the system. I might have disturbed it that way. So let me instead move myself to a new position. Galilean invariance says that's the same story. I could also move this system. Here it is again. Move this system in a uniform velocity back and forth. But no, I'm not entitled to move the system, which I replace here. I do myself moving in a uniform velocity, or perhaps even faster. Okay. So I have two kinds of variations that I can make on this system, which is so small now you can't see it, and still have never disturbed it. One of those is a change of its position, and the other is a change of its Fourier transform, a translation of the Fourier transform. Put those two together as a single story, I get a displacement and a phase factor, and that amounts to coherent states. That's a definition of coherent states. In an abstract notation, this would involve the momentum operator P, the coordinate operator Q. These would be unitary transformations to preserve the norm of that. That means I must deal with self-adjoint operators, Q and P. And acting on my basic state, my state to enter that I to play the game, that gives me my coherent states. Many choices I could make for eta. Let's do the simplest one, which is the ground state of the harmonic oscillator, right there. Okay. Here we go. I take my quantum action, and I restrict the variations I can make as a macroscopic person on my microscopic system. They are the coherent states. Put that into that storm, and lo and behold, I get this answer. I get PQ dot minus Hamiltonian P and Q. And what is the definition of this quantity? It's the expectation value of the Hamiltonian operator in the coherent states. It has the functional form of a classical Hamiltonian. P and Q, I will shortly tell you what their physical meaning are, but they can be independently specified. After all, they were parameters in the unitary transformations involved. Now, I'm going to make the assertion that these guys, this statement here, means that quantum mechanics is, I beg your pardon, classical mechanics is quantum mechanics restricted to a certain two-dimensional surface in Hilbert space. If you haven't heard that sentence before, you're going to choke on it because you never believed that before. But let's keep it in mind as a possibility for today's lecture. Okay. So what about canonical transformations? Here is the restricted form of the quantum action where I put in the coherent states and it gives me the classical action. This is how coordinates are related to each other, PQ and P tilde, Q tilde, for a canonical transformation. And I'm going to assert that the coherent states transform as scalars. That means they transform in such a way that this is the same vector in Hilbert space as this is, just labeled differently. Now that's a trouble with Dirac notation, is that if this is 3 and 4, and this could be 5 and 6, but in which system is it working? That's Dirac, don't worry about that. But this is the fact that I'm going to just let it go that way. So that means if this equals that, I can replace it down here. And then all that says is I take the PDQ, which I have here, use that formula, and I get this new formula down here. H transforms as a scalar itself. So I get the classical action in the new frame of canonical coordinates. That's canonical transformation. But no change of the operators, no change of the quantum theory has taken place. What about the Cartesian coordinates? Here is my definition of the classical Hamiltonian, the thing that plays the classical Hamiltonian. In fact, I should be calling it the enhanced classical Hamiltonian because H bar is still positive there. It's the expectation value of the quantum operator, which means I just simply translate capital P by little p, capital Q by little q, and take the expectation value in my choice of eta. Imagine this to be a polynomial. So q plus q, let's say, to the 10th power. Expand that out. One of those terms is always C number. One of those terms is purely C number, this guy to the 10th power, and he belongs here. Every other term in that expansion contains operators. And so they will have expectation values of order h bar. So they belong over there. So here I have the functional form of the quantum operator equaling the functional form of the classical Hamiltonian. That's exactly what we mean by Cartesian coordinates. But where are the Cartesian coordinates? They cannot come from the phase space. Here's the physical meaning of little p and little q. They are the expectation value of cap p and cap q in the coherent states, and of course, they can be simultaneously specialized. I'm still focusing on where the metric, the Cartesian coordinates, can come from. Well, we're dealing with Hilbert space. A Hilbert space has a metric. Forget the alpha for a moment. Let's set this to 1, this term here. Forget the minimization. Psi minus phi in magnitude squared is a good distance squared on Hilbert space. But we know that the phase of any vector in quantum mechanics has no physics. So let's minimize over that phase and get the distance squared for rays. Well, I do that Then I take the infinitesimal difference between a coherent state and a nearby coherent state. This equation collapses down to this. I put in a multiplier for dimensions, and lo and behold, for the chosen parameterization, we get dp squared plus dq squared. There is a metric. There is a metric on phase space, arising from the Hilbert space. But of course, I am generous. I will now award that metric to the classical phase space. At this point, believe it or not, we have reproduced, or we are equivalent, traditional canonical quantization. What do I mean? The job of canonical quantization is to choose Cartesian coordinates. I now know how to do that. Choose operators associated with that and Hamiltonians, which have the same functional form as the classical one. That's canonical quantization. We have now agreed with that. Here's a summary. This is the quantum story, which leads to Schrödinger's equation. I can't vary all of those states as a macroscopic person. I can only do limited things. We discussed it. I don't want to do my running exercise again, but you get the point. Coherent states are how they come in. Those are the states I can do. And lo and behold, I get classical mechanics.
Just a question. Why do you choose this phase?
A lot much louder.
Why do you choose? I mean, is there any meaning of choosing this particular phase for the coherent states? Like, do you have
any of this vector?
No. The order in QP or Q plus P, or you could have.
Oh, that's a phase, right?
Yeah, you could have. You know, it's up to a phase.
Okay, sure, fine. If I put them in the same exponent, this would become 1/2 PQ dot minus QP dot.
Okay, so the phase is.
That's all it does. So that's a more advanced way to look at the kinetic part, the time derivative part, but we do it this way. Okay.
So
now, louder.
Yeah, can I summarize what you just said by saying, so here you seem to say that quantum mechanics is the same thing as classical mechanics plus the new structure is this metric on phase space.
That the new functions beyond which those that I can vary, not the coherent states, but the linear superposition of the coherent states, which I cannot do in an expectation.
But what about this metric on phase space?
What about the metric on phase space?
Yes.
It never exists on classical phase space. Yes, I can freely award it to classical phase space because it is generated by the Hilbert space.
So, but what element of quantum mechanics does that capture?
What part of quantum mechanics? That is a Cartesian metric. If I have, as Dirac said it, you came in a few minutes late. You missed Dirac's story. If I take the classical Hamiltonian and substitute that by quantum operators, then this is a fine candidate for the classical Hamiltonian, for the quantum Hamiltonian, up to order H bar corrections that might come from factor ordering, et cetera, things like that. That is what the Cartesian coordinates can do for you. If I take P squared plus Q squared as a harmonic oscillator, let's do it classically first. I can make that into a P tilde of a new canonical family. If I made this into an operator with continuous spectrum, then it would certainly not equal this operator, which has a discrete spectrum. So this is the one that I want to focus on with Cartesian coordinates. Okay, so you've all had a chance to read this. Could there be other two-dimensional sheets of Hilbert space vectors? That we had a sheet of Hilbert space vectors made by the unitary transformations acting on a fixed vector. Is there another possibility for that? And the answer is yes. Now, I don't want to leave the canonical story too far away, so we're going to take a consequence of the canonical story. Up in the top, we have the Poisson bracket between little q and p, which is unity, and I've simply multiplied that by little q. Bring that little q inside as this, and call that combination little d for the word dilation. So little q and little d, Poisson bracket, gives me a little q. They are not canonical variables, but they do make a Lie algebra. And I'm telling you, they can be used as coordinates, not canonical coordinates, but coordinates to describe the classical mechanics. The same thing happens for the Heisenberg relation. Capital Q comma capital P equals IH bar multiplied by capital Q. Bring the capital Q inside. Symmetrize by adding and subtracting. The difference part disappears. I get capital D associated with little d, which is the Hermitian combination of these two guys. So that's the quantum dilation story. And this is called an affine commutator, and these are called affine variables, q and d. Let's take the case where q and p were irreducible, equivalent to the Schrodinger representation. They cover the whole real line. Their spectrum is the whole real line, so they're irreducible. When I multiply by q and get this commutation relationship, q and d are actually reducible because d acts like dilation, and therefore I can deal with capital Q alone, or q can be totally negative as well. So there are at least these two different subdivisions, if you will, of this reducibility. We're going to focus on the case for Q positive for a while. And we can have self-adjoint operators Q and D, Q here, with Q positive. I could not choose Q and P when I dealt with a world in which capital Q was positive. You should know this. If capital Q is positive, and then I try to make capital P with it, it cannot be made into a self-adjoint operator. And I want self-adjoint operators to generate unitary transformations to make my coherent states. Now, these are called affine coherent states. Little p before, just the same way. But now I have natural log of little q and d. I will use dimensions where little q, capital Q are dimensionless. And so capital D carries all the dimensions of H bar, for example. Here's the definition of my vector I shall choose. It's a linear combination of the generators. These set of coherent states may be less familiar to than the canonical kind. This is the overlap. They have a resolution of unity, etc. We have focused so far on this slide in the world where capital Q was positive because little q was positive. But I could also talk about capital Q being negative and q, little q being negative, or I can even talk about the union of the two as a reducible representation. Forget the little guy in the middle, q equals zero, and you have something which also covers the whole line, just like the canonical guys did. And in fact, we will find that the affine world can double, if you will, as affine guys. Affine guys will double as canonical guys. So let's look at the story from their point of view. I have a Hamiltonian now, which depends on these self-adjoint operators, D and Q. P and Q were the labels of my affine coherent states. I make that restriction, put that in here, and lo and behold, this formula comes out. Minus q p dot, a bit like Laurent was talking about, of having a different phase convention. Again, the Hamiltonian function is the expectation now in the affine coherent states of this operator. Why not d? Where's d? Well, the labels of this guy were p and q. That's what we have here. Q canonical transformation, the same story we had before, p tilde q tilde vector equals pq vector. Put that in, and I get a standard canonical transformation of the classical action. But again, no change. No change of the quantum operator. Here is how these guys are defined. I'm going to call this Hamiltonian, not PQ now, but let's put it as PQ, Q, because that's what D stands for. The expectation value is written this way as well, PQ times capital Q, little q times capital Q. The expectation of capital Q is 1. It can't be 0, because we've chosen capital Q to be strictly positive. And this turns out, again, to be H, the same functional form as this, plus H-bar corrections. This is, again, like the Cartesian story that we had before. Just drop that little Q, drop that little Q, and it would be the same formula. Could it be the Cartesian coordinates are important again? No, not truly. Here's the physical meaning of these guys, as it should be, little q. And here is the metric. It carries the name Fubini Studi to Italian guys who studied this problem long ago. And instead of being dp squared plus dq squared, this is a Poincaré half plane, geodesically complete in that half plane. Now, I normally don't talk about this, but since this is such a bright audience, I'll give it a shot. We've been talking about Q positive, Q negative. I could pivot it around another point. Suppose I made a translation. So now Q is going to could go all the way down to minus gamma. Imagine that. Q going to Q plus gamma. Here it is, Q plus gamma squared. Here it is, Q plus gamma to the minus 2. And then I let beta itself be proportional to gamma squared and then go to infinity. That really means that this term disappears and this term disappears, and I go back to a Cartesian metric. Yes, it's true. You can take affine quantization and move the origin where Q is positive to Q is greater than minus gamma and then push that gamma all the way out, and lo and behold, the result is canonical coherent states and canonical quantization. So in that silly sense, affine could be more basic. Here's the summary. The classical action arises by a restriction of the quantum action to coherent states. Canonical quantization uses P and Q, which must be self-adjoint. Now, typically, we don't fuss about P and Q being self-adjoint when we quantize. It has to be Hermitian, sure, but not self-adjoint. I need self-adjoint because they're going to be generators of the unitary transformations building the coherent states. If I have a situation in which capital Q is positive, I cannot use it with capital P, period. So I have to find another variable. That was the D. And so affine quantization makes those guys self-adjoint for Q positive, Q negative, or the union of both of them. Both canonical and affine quantum stories are consistent with a classical canonical phase space variables P and Q. So you look at a phase space action functional classically, and you don't know a priori whether I should quantize it canonically or with affine. Okay, now it's time for some applications.
Question.
Yes, sir.
You say
louder.
No, you say you don't know whether to quantize it canonically or affine. Canonically really means Cartesian, is that?
It means what?
Cartesian.
Yeah, Cartesian would be Cartesian.
Because in some way of looking at it, both of them are canonical forms of canonical quantization.
Fine. I'm not fussing about words for you.
No, I just want to make sure I understand.
Quite. I concede the point. So here is my first toy model. This is general relativity. You don't recognize it. Little q stands for the metric, and this is its signature property. Little p stands for minus the Christoffel symbol. We want to study that as a classical toy model and see what happens. Are there singularities? If there are classical singularities, can they be removed by the quantization? Well, it's so easy. Vary the Q, this is the equation for the P. Solve the P, here it is. This is the energy, it must be a constant. This is the form Q must have, and we're done with the solution. Notice the Q is typically positive, but it can be zero. It will be zero if P0 is finite, itself not zero. So there are singularities in this model for every case with a positive energy solution. We're going to look at canonical quantum corrections to this story and affine quantum corrections. And we'll see that affine resolves the singularities. And a second classical model will have similar properties. So this page is totally devoted to model number one. We've already seen these first two lines. Canonical quantization. Well, the Hamiltonian is ambiguous up to H bar in conventional quantization. So I'm going to adapt a choice. I'm going to take PQP, which would be a natural choice here, and take the canonical coherent states and get QP squared plus a positive multiple times Q equal to H bar squared over 2. Well, the solutions look like this. They not only have one singularity, they have repeated singularities. As A, or H bar, goes to zero, you recover these equations. Instead, now let me use affine. So what do? I multiply by another Q and divide by Q. The two Q's upstairs go with a P. QP is a little d, which becomes a capital D. Capital D, Q inverse, capital D. That's my Hamiltonian in affine variables. I take the expectation value of that in affine coherent states. I get QP squared, the same story we want, plus a H bar squared constant divided by little Q. So this is what plays the role of the classical Hamiltonian. I want to call it the enhanced Hamiltonian, enhanced classical Hamiltonian, because H bar is there. And of course, that does everything we want it to do. Capital C, I assure you, is a positive quantity. And it means that Q can never go to zero because that would violate the constant of energy. And here is the functional form of the solution for P and for Q, and it stays away from zero. So there's a bounce there. Singularity of this model is removed with the affine quantization. And this procedure, similar procedure, has recently been studied by Manuel and Zonetti for the Robertson-Walker type problems. And they find analogous good features. Here's number two. This is a case where we're going to use the reducible representation. So we have the affine variables. I'm not going to talk canonical at all here. We have Q greater than zero and Q less than zero. Both of them. Our basic vector here has a positive and a direct sum with a negative component. The Q expectation value there is plus 1 or minus 1, depending on whether you're in one of those. Here's my model, minus QP dot, and it's a P squared minus E squared over Q. E squared is to remind you of the hydrogen atom. It's like a one-dimensional hydrogen atom. You can study that model, and you'll find that the solutions tend to go into the origin to a singularity in a finite time. Here is the restricted form. This will give us an enhanced Hamiltonian right here. And this is the structure by which it's made. And it comes out to look like this. 1/2 p squared minus something over q, just like this was. But we get an extra term, c prime over q squared. This Q squared is positive, and as Q gets smaller, it will dominate the story and forbid the solution to go to zero. Moreover, Q is like a length. Q squared is like a length squared. So the relation between C prime and C is a length between them. This term is proportional to E squared. This term is proportional to h bar squared over m. Remember, I chose q basically as dimensionless, so that gives P all the H bar dimensions. Put that together, and we find that C prime is related to C by a length, which is the Bohr radius. In other words, this toy model has its minimum in the vicinity of the Bohr radius. Now, I would like to call that the true classical theory, because H bar is positive in the world you live in. And when H bar is positive, this theory is like that. Okay, summing up the toy models. They exhibited classical singularities. The canonical story did not solve it. The affine did. Enhanced quantization can eliminate singularities. Now, topic three. Yeah, question. Yes, sir.
In the case, if you apply this to the L,
louder.
If you apply this to the L equals zero mode of the hydrogen atom, do you get the same spectrum, or is there some displacement of the spectrum?
Okay, so he asks about the spectrum and its displacement. Now, these numerical coefficients, C and C prime, are derived from expectation values of a vector I have arbitrarily subscribed in there. If I change that vector, or you choose a different vector, we will get slightly different coefficients here. These are projections in an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. We are taking a projection from one point of view, or another point of view, or yet another point of view, and they can have different coefficients. So it's difficult to say, do I get exactly one question or another question? But I get the qualitative features of those things. Okay. Now, this model, the third model, the last model, the most complex model, and actually the most interesting one. I'm going to talk about n degrees of freedom, P and Q, and n will be both finite and infinite. P squared is obvious what it is. Of course, when we deal with an infinite number of these, then individually the P squared sum should be finite and the Q squared sum should be finite. The classical Hamiltonian here, it's nonlinear because of this extra coefficient as long as lambda 0 is positive. And it's perfectly well defined for n finite and n infinite. The quantum theory, on the other hand, will be well defined. And here is my quantum Hamiltonian. This is my association with the enhanced classical Hamiltonian for n finite. We're going to discuss the difficulties that happen when you try to make n in infinity and quantize this particular problem. How are we going to solve that problem? We're going to actually find this is a model in which the quantum theory goes to the free theory, goes to a free theory. It's not a good choice. But there's something left open we haven't yet explored about this. Namely, the expectation value of P and Q of the quantum Hamiltonian will necessarily be a function of P and Q alone. There could be other operators here. Now, of course, if I have the identity operator here, that's no big deal. But suppose I have an operator here which is not the identity, and yet which commutes with P and Q. That makes this a reducible representation of the Heisenberg algebra. That's verboten in the traditional canonical quantization. You have to have irreducible representation. But I could have this and other operators here and still come up with something here. What would be the substitute for reducibility? I would ask that these vectors span the Hilbert space. That's all I have to do. And there's no guarantee or requirement that they have to be irreducible. So we're going to find the reducible form. Here's the standard story. Here again is the model. It's invariant under rotations here. There are three invariants, P squared, P dot Q, Z, Q squared. Energy and angular momentum are expressible in the invariants. This line is quantization. P goes to capital P, little q goes to capital Q, Heisenberg commutation relation. I put on double dot wick ordering to remove the infinity. Indeed, if the interaction term was absent, you would want yourself to put on Wick ordering and remove that ground state energy. But we have an extra term here, and we want to normal order that. That works. It gives you a quantization, a form of quantization for n finite. But you cannot take the limit of that story n to infinity and get something interesting. Indeed, this term here grows like capital N. And as n goes to infinity, that would be a catastrophe. So what you have to do is you have to change this coupling constant to a new coupling constant, which is more or less held fixed, divided by capital N. So when n gets large, we have this small coefficient, 1 over n, in front of that. Now, you're familiar, I hope, perhaps, if not personally, but by reputation, with 1 over n expansions, 1 over n analysis. That's all a possible story. I'm interested in the n equals infinity story. The n equals infinity story works for the classical theory. When I take n equals infinity here, it is going to push this thing down to a possible multiple of another q squared. So it would add to the mass. In other words, it would be a free theory. In the next slide, I'm going to give another demonstration of that very fact. But of course, if I took the classical limit of what I got for that n equals infinity, I would get a free classical theory, different from what I started with. That is not good physics. Let's look at the same problem a slightly different way. We talked about the Hamiltonian and the Hamiltonian operator. I'm going to take a Schrodinger equation with a unique ground state. No surprise to that. We typically do that. Phi n of x with a full rotational symmetry. So this r is simply the radius vector for all those coordinates. I'm going to take the Fourier transform of the ground state distribution. That's how I'm going to examine my ground state distribution. Phi n squared, it's a real function. I square it. This becomes my ground state distribution. This is the Fourier transform of that. I use the fact that this is rotationally invariant. So I replace this guy by psi n of r squared. And moreover, let's go from these coordinate Cartesian coordinates to spherical coordinates. So that's r to the n minus 1 dr, first angle sine of theta n to the minus 2 d theta, and then all the rest of the angles. Now I'm going to integrate that. How can I possibly integrate? Because I don't know what this function is. One variable, I do know what it is. I do know the sine of theta enters here, and the cosine of theta is there. Sine of theta, okay, I'll do it for you. Sine of theta looks like this, okay? Here's theta equal pi over 2. This is theta equal 0. This is theta equal pi. If I now raise that to a huge power, it gets narrower and narrower and narrower and looks like a Gaussian. So with this large power here, this is a Gaussian, and I can use steepest descent evaluation to integrate the theta. And by the way, then the cosine theta is a linear theta at that point. So I get this particular leading term, a Gaussian, which gives the square of the PR squared term, divided by the 2, that comes from here at h bar squared, constant, and the R integration left, and the angles, which don't do much. Now I take the limit n to infinity. That limit n to infinity will be some integral left over with a e to the minus something p squared, that's built in now, and a little b, f of b db, that's the ending form. I'm assuming, again, that this integral converges. That's why this limit converges. That's why we can do this. This is a non-negative function, which is integrates to 1. So this, indeed, and there's a theorem to this effect, that all infinitely dimensionally rotationally invariant characteristic functions, Fourier transforms of positive distributions, are superpositions of Gaussians. Now, that's the symmetry part of the problem. I want to now invoke the uniqueness part of the problem, which says there's only one ground state. And lo and behold, only one form of delta will do that. F rather does that as a delta function, which means this is my limiting form for C infinity P. A Gaussian, the Fourier transform of that would again be another Gaussian, so we've got a free field story. No matter what interaction I put in, Q squared squared, as we were talking about in the previous line, Q squared to the 40th, they all have the same disease. Okay. Let's review the story of magic dots. I'm going to define the expectation value of this linear combination upstairs by two dots as follows, without the dots here, and then I divide by its expectation value in my chosen state eta. That simply means, of course, that the eta expectation value of this particular left-hand side gives me something over something, which gives me 1. Now I use the definition of my coherent states and ask for the diagonal coherent state matrix element of this double dot formula. Recognizing that that simply translates p plus little p q plus little q, then I can bring little q and little p outside because they're C numbers, they come outside like this, and what's left over is eta, the expectation value at eta of without the little p, without the q, which we've already agreed is unity. Now, for any choice of eta, a normalized vector, I have shown you that this expectation value has the same functional form as that one. The operators between the double dots have the same functional form as that. So linear combinations of this will look like linear combinations of that. In particular, I can say, let's add that up to make my Hamiltonian double dot. That's going to be expectation value, the nice Hamiltonian. End of story. No. There's a problem with this. You might get a form instead of an operator. Now, who does not know what a form is? Any hands going up? I won't look. Just say yes. Somebody know? Somebody? Everybody knows form? Very good. Okay, we won't review it. A form is no good. We need an operator. And the operator test is that when I square this quantity I've got, it has well-defined expectation values. They are not infinite, they are finite. You know this story in a certain sense already. Suppose I chose this to be p squared plus q squared. Suppose this was going to be harmonic oscillator type. And you know that I'm subtracting off by this the ground state. But that belongs to the ground state of the problem. So that eta should be the ground state for that Hamiltonian in order to have a true operator and not a form. Okay, enough idea. We need to make sure we have an operator there. Okay, the next part of the problem, yes, sir.
Is it true that your normal ordering is just a rescaling of the operator? That's how it looks.
Heavens, no.
Did I read that?
Heavens, no.
So
I'm subtracting.
That's what I didn't understand. Go back.
Okay.
Look at the top.
Fine. Wait, hang on. Alpha, I'm going to take a derivative with respect to alpha that'll bring down a p. So that alpha will affect this alpha and it will affect this alpha. The two derivatives of alpha will affect these and this one, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a leading term which is traditional p, but then I have to subtract off terms. Okay?
And is this equivalent to the usual normal ordering, or is it different?
If indeed, if this is the ground state of a harmonic oscillator, this is the true normal ordering, the traditional one.
For those of that form.
For capital Q and capital P, and so my eta.
I mean those exponential.
Of course. Yeah. They're made from Q and P.
Yeah.
But you can get any by taking derivatives.
What did he say?
He said you can get anything else by taking derivatives.
Yes, sure.
But then would that formula would not apply, I assume, to the derivative?
You get a form. You can get forms all you like. You can't get operators so easily.
What is a form?
What is a form? Bless you. Okay. So let me take the... the notation here, which would look like psi A phi. Now, we expect that A could be a bad guy, and so I have to limit the phis. Bra ket, so I'm limiting kets. But for a form, I also have to limit bra. Watch. Suppose I put delta of x in my function. That's my operator. I make this a nice continuous function, smooth at the origin, L2. That's going to work for that guy. But this guy, if he's a general L2 vector, he could be like psi of x, 1 over x to the 1/3, e to the minus x squared. He could blow up at infinity. That's still square integrable. That would be hell for the operation, letting this act on that function. So I've got to limit these guys as well as these guys. An operator, on the other hand, a true operator, makes this a vector, and then this can be any other vector in the Hilbert space. For a true operator, especially self-adjoint as we want, we can square it, we can cube it, we can fourth part it. Not at all true for forms. Okay, so here's the story. And I lost my pretty girl. I'll bring her back right now. Wrong pocket. Right. Okay, so what am I going to show you? I'm going to show you the answer. Now the answer is undeniable when you see it, but there is a heck of a lot of omitted work, which is the proof that this is the unique answer. I'm not going to do that for you. I'm just going to give you the plausible answer. It's been published, and so if you're thirsty for a rigorous story, you can find that. Here we go. Let's look at a test case first, up at the top. Here's my ground state. Here's my coherent states. Here is my free particle, Hamiltonian. That's a good operator. And lo and behold, the square of that operator is a good operator. I tell you, this is a good operator for this vector being associated that way. If this had a different m here, that would not be a good operator. It would be a form. So what I'm saying is I have a good operator here, and lo and behold, I'm just going to add the square of it and see what happens. Using the magic dots, it says capital P goes to little p, capital Q goes to little q, capital P goes to little p, capital Q goes to little q. That's the functional form. So I've found something with q squared squared. But there's a price to have been paid. The price is I've got unwanted p squared. Well, I could let p equal to 0, but then I would lose it here. It's a test case. It's a test case telling you that the square of this guy is also worth looking at. So here's the true answer. We introduce a whole new set of p's and q's. They're called r's and s's. The R's and the S's have Heisenberg commutation between themselves, but they commute with the P's and Q's. This is the reducibility of the story. I put Q plus IP, that would look like this, but then I mix in a little bit of S. Zeta is between 0 and 1. Here is S and R, that would be a separate oscillator, but I mix in a little bit of Q. So this vector, which can be the simultaneous ground state for those two operators, This looks like e to the minus 1 half x squared minus 1 half y squared, and then a cross term, like minus zeta xy. It's as simple as that. There it is. And these are my coherent states. And these are my coherent state value, expectation value of a Hamiltonian. What is that Hamiltonian? That Hamiltonian is the square associated with this operator, this one times its Hermitian conjugate. The same thing for the R guys. And then I square the second guys and take the expectation value. And what is the answer? We use the magic dots. Big P goes to little p. Big Q goes to little q. Little s goes to nothing. Nothing, because I haven't excited those variables. From this guy, only the q comes out, times an m squared times a zeta squared. This guy gives a q squared squared. There it is. M squared squared, m fourth, there it is. Zeta to the fourth, there, and nu is the coefficient. And lo and behold, that is the answer. You would never find that from canonical quantization. Okay. I keep putting that in my pocket. So here's the summary of the rotational model. This is a model which is classically non-trivial, goes to a quantum theory, which is trivial. Take the classical limit, it is again trivial. So it doesn't agree with its original classical theory. We found a way to beat that. Conventional quantization works for these models if n is finite, but leads to triviality if n is infinite. The enhanced quantization procedure applies for reducible operator representations. This is called the weak correspondence principle, this connection between the quantum Hamiltonian and the classical Hamiltonian, where h bar is still positive. A non-trivial quantization results if n is finite or infinite, and there are no divergences, no divergences. This is an infinite number of degree of freedom problem, which is a nonlinear problem, and there's no divergences. The classical and quantum formalism is similar for all n. What have we accomplished in today's talk? Canonical quantization requires Cartesian coordinates, but why they require that is not clear. Canonical quantization works well for certain problems, but not for all problems. Enhanced quantization, that is, this using the coherent states and the restriction of the quantum action functional, enhanced quantization clarifies the coordinate transformation and gives meaning to the Cartesian coordinate. It can yield canonical results or provide better results, like we saw for the affine or the reducible story here, when canonical results fail. So this program has been underway for a while. The simple models that we talked about are two models, one with the Bohr radius and things like that. That's ongoing. Covariant scalar models, 5 to the 4th in 4 and higher dimensions. Canonically is free. Lecture in this room, in this building, in 2010, I've offered a solution to that. Affine quantum gravity, I've lectured here several times about that. Incorporating systems with enhanced constrained systems within that started. Additional sheets of Hilbert space vectors. We talked about the canonical coherent states that make a sheet of vectors, the affine coherent states making a sheet of vectors. Are there more being studied? Can this extend to fermion systems? That's a difficult problem. I'm having difficulty with that. But it's an interesting thing, and there are some hints to do that. So this is the main message of today. The classical quantum coexistence is possible. H-bar need not ever go to zero, and it is beneficial. I realize you are all attached to your sacred cows. And the sacred cow you have is that C and Q, classical and quantum, are separate worlds. One is H bar zero. That's the traditional way we quantize. Please try to look at the master of the sacred cow and see if he is worthy of staying with him completely. On the other hand, I offer to you a situation in which H bar stays positive, classical is a part of the quantum theory, and there are some beneficial things that can happen from that. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Yeah.
So you alluded to the lambda phi 4 theory.
What about it?
So now that the Higgs has been found, presumably, the Higgs particle
is
such a...
Yes. So it should exist. There should be a quantum field theory for it, right?
Yeah, yes.
I'm smiling. Right.
So does this affect anything in the standard model? Or, I mean, what implications would this have for the Higgs field?
Louder.
What implication would your enhanced quantization have for the Higgs field?
The traditional quantization, canonical quantization of a scalar nonlinear phi to the fourth theory is a quantum free theory. I can beat that. I can give you a quantum non-free theory, which has a classical limit, which is also non-free.
So that, I mean, that should have some implications about the so-called fine-tuning problem.
Which kind of problem?
Fine-tuning.
Fine-tuning.
Which I think have to do with precisely with evading the Higgs field becoming free.
But, I mean, what they have found, which is quite remarkable, I mean, I have another question, but what they have found, which is quite remarkable, is that the value they found for the coupling parameter of the Higgs is such that the Lando pole, that is where really you have a problem, is below the Planck scale.
So, right, but there wouldn't be one here. So
that's the question. So will there be, what happens to the Lando pole?
I got a bad hearing.
What happens to the Lando pole?
Landau pole. The Landau pole is based on the idea that you make a perturbation about the genuine free theory. The alternative approach I am offering is not a expansion about the genuine free theory. It's an expansion about a different counter term. Not one suggested by perturbation theory. I gave a lecture in this room, it's in 2010, Pearson, about that story. So the Landau ghost story originating from perturbation about the free theory is inapplicable.
So, I mean, okay. What I was saying for the Higgs model is that there's kind of a conspiracy, or a good conspiracy for particle physics, which is that whatever the Landau pole is, it's inaccessible. That is, it could have been in a range which is like TeV or higher. Yeah. It turns out it's below Planck scale, so it's completely hidden by quantum gravity. So it's
kind below of... You mean below in length?
Yeah, its energy is higher than the Planck mass, which means that in fact, you know, it's not there for all practical purposes. Which is, it's maybe the biggest result of the CERN is really that it's about the location of the Lando pole. That's all the rest was known. It's really the fact that the Lando pole is invisible is a total surprise. This is the only surprise that's in the CERN result.
So summarize what he's saying loudly.
Well,
he's saying that with the current parameters, this Landau pole is
far,
actually at an energy.
It's far away.
It's far away.
Yeah. That's also true.
So it doesn't, there might be no effect from comparing the two methods of quantization. There might be no difference in this case.
Another analogous problem. Let's look at this problem. Well, here we go, better here. This problem here is an analogous problem. So, conventional procedures, as n gets huge, force this coefficient to be so small that the quartic character of it is infinitesimal. That is what you're perturbing about in a 1 over n expansion, or perturbing about in a Landau series that would sum up to a Landau pole. On the other hand, up at the top, in the classical theory, I have as big a coefficient of the Q squared as I want. In short, this classical theory is far, far removed from what you would expect for its quantum theory, and that's borne out by the fact that the classical limit of this quantum theory is miles away from that classical theory. So, to say, what you were ever saying, and I forgot, of course, right now, I challenge.
I was just quoting.
Thank you. I'll challenge him.
So you say that there would be. So are you, when you say challenge?
Would be.
That means there will be a practical difference between this quantization.
Yes.
And the traditional one, even in the standard model with its current parameters. The current mass of the Higgs.
The quantization I am offering is. What do I say? Natural. It goes to a non-trivial quantum theory and goes back to the original classical theory. You guys are saddled in the fight of the fourth theory with one that doesn't do that.
So, is it that you
don't use
the usual Fock space?
Again?
So you are not using the usual Fock space.
Fock space?
You're not using the usual Fock space.
Where? For this model?
So basically, in standards,
I am using the usual Fock space for a doubling of the set of variables. In fact, if I allowed the R and S variables, that's the wrong model to talk about. I mean, it is, but later on. If I put the R and the S variables up in the exponent here with little r, little s, made coherent states for them, then everybody would be lit up. There would be little r squares here, squared, etc. So that's a good Fock space. That's absolutely a good Fock space. Yes.
But even in the limit you n goes to infinity, you say it's the same Hilbert space. In the limit n goes to infinity,
yes.
You say it's the same Hilbert space.
Yes.
You have the same vacuum.
I have twice as many degrees of freedom. But each of them looks Fock-like. Here are the annihilation operators acting on the ground state to give me zero. These are the ANs, if you will. These are the BNs acting, giving me zero. That makes it a very Fock space.
There's a more. So the question is rather whether you can map to the original Fock space.
Fine, every Hilbert space is the same as you can be mapped to every other Hilbert space, infinite dimensional.
No, I mean you cannot. If it's a question whether it's usually unitary transformations. Okay, again.
I'm not getting it.
I mean, so it could be not there's a condition to do that. Sum over the coefficients has to converge. Okay.
Sorry, here it will.
I think it's a question. I think it's a question of which algebra are you representing in the two different cases. Is it true that you've actually changed the algebra of operators that you're working with when you use the enhanced quantization? Because you have these affine commutation relations.
Well, the previous enhanced quantizations did not use the reducible operator story. They used P and Q or D and Q. And they were, more close to what we typically believe of quantization. This is a different extension of a different kind. I don't know what else to say to that.
But would it have the same algebra in the end? Is there an isomorphism between the algebra of operators that you have in this quantization? Whether or not it's reducible or irreducible, do you have the same algebra, or is it actually a different algebra?
Well, the P's and the Q's are the same Heisenberg algebra. The D's and the Q's are the affine algebra, which is a consequence of the Heisenberg algebra.
Uh-huh.
And in this model, the P's and the Q's are canonical, and the R's and the S are a separate other canonical pair. The algebras are really straightforward.
So are the P's and Q's, are the P's and Q's that you, I don't understand, are they a subset of the larger, do the P's, you said the P's and Q's commute with the R's and
Yeah.
And F's. So you have two commuting
yeah.
subalgebras, one of which alone is isomorphic to the usual
yes.
algebra.
Yes. And being isomorphic, being irreducible, fails because we proved that it gives only a Gaussian ground state, hence a free theory. So, irreducibility was dooming the problem to failure. And those of you who work with large N stories, I think, might like to study this idea.
And is the representation irreducible for the full algebra or just for the P's? If you include the R's and S's and P's.
Then it's irreducible.
Then it's irreducible.
That's correct.
Okay.
Right. Okay. Thank you, guys.